This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest once again today is Miles Traphagen, who's Borderlands Program Coordinator for the Wildlands Network. We talked to Miles last week, but we had a lot more to talk about, so welcome back, Miles.
Thanks for having me back, Jay. Appreciate it.
Okay. Just wanted to get started by, it's been hot down there in the Southwest. You're in Tucson, and it gets pretty warm down there. I'm just wondering how the heat has affected wildlife this summer. I've heard that some plants have been destroyed because of the heat. It's been so hot.
Yeah, that's what we're really seeing is the effect on the vegetation down here. Everywhere you go, you see a lot of dead trees and saguaro cactus, even creosote, which is the most adapted desert shrub that there is. They're all looking really rusty, kind of this brown color. There's no green on them. This is about as bad as I've ever seen it. But as far as the wildlife, it's really difficult to say what's going on with that. You know, it's something that you don't really see until, you know, maybe the next year. Because, you know, you don't know you're in a drought until basically, you know, the drought is, you're well into it and it's over. And so, you know, we'll see what happens next year. But, you know, on a good note is that I was down in New Mexico last week, southern part of New Mexico, and I saw really healthy populations of deer and pronghorn down there.
I've heard that
rattlesnakes.
I've heard some fish have been affected by the warm water too. Have you had any indication of that?
No, because we don't have much surface water here in the Tucson area.
Yeah,
you have to talk to somebody in a more well watered environment to get that info.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the border fence. Does the border fence constitute, we know it affects larger mammals, but how about birds or reptiles? Have they been affected by the border fence?
Yeah, desert tortoise have been because, you know, a tortoise is not very flexible. And if they are wider than 4 inches, then they're not going to be able to get through. And in fact, I've seen tortoises in the same locations in the mountains south of here, you know, pacing along the border wall fence. In fact, we've got a lot of video and photos of that happening. But also birds are affected by that, birds and butterflies. Because, you know, even though birds can fly, there's a lot of birds that really don't fly that high. You know, think about, you know, quail, for example. You know, they do that quick burst, and, you know, they might get 8-10 feet up in the air.
Yeah.
And then kind of land. And so I've seen a lot of birds that are just interacting with the wall, not in a good way. You kind of see them fly towards it, split around, and then turn back. So it's not that it's an impossibility like it would be for a larger animal, but it's definitely a lot more difficult for some species.
How about roadrunners? Do they get turned back?
You know, they would be thin enough to fit through. In fact, I've seen roadrunners go through the fence.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And reptiles? Are the openings at the ground level?
Yeah, they're at ground level. And so you know, I've seen rattlesnakes going through the wall and, of course, lizards. When I was over in Poland in September, where they built a border wall between Poland and Belarus, they had a concrete footer that went up about, you know, 2 feet above the ground. And then they had these little, like, looks like they probably molded them with 4-inch pipe that they called wildlife passages. But they weren't at grade level. They were, you know, still a foot above the ground. So their situation over there is even worse for the small mammals and any reptiles, too.
How about the land that's been bulldozed? Is that, and so there's, I guess, a wide open space. Does that constitute a border crossing barrier?
No, it's just unsightly and just really destructive. It's really sad to see a lot of these beautiful mountains and buttes that were iconic along the border. There's a mountain called Fresnel Peak, which is near the Tohono O'odham Reservation and on the Coronado National Forest, and they just blasted right through the top of that thing. Just a beautiful pink rhyolite peak, which was covered in this yellow lichen and a lot of interesting vegetation along there, and they just blasted right through the thing. And they've since, you know, remediated the damage, meaning that they graded the slope so that it was beyond the, or it was, you know, at a settling angle of repose is what it would be called, as opposed to a lot of these big piles of rubble were very unstable. They were beyond that angle so that, you know, any sort of disturbance, you know, could possibly dislodge that and cause basically an avalanche.
Right. Well, in order to build the wall, back at that time, Trump's Homeland Secretary Mike Chertoff, he secured the ability to override several legislative acts that would have otherwise prohibited the wall, but they neutralized those. So I'm just wondering, what were those acts? The Endangered Species Act, Migratory Bird Treaty Act, what others?
Well, that was the Real ID Act of 2005, and so the Homeland Secretary has the ability to do that. Michael Chertoff was actually the Homeland Security Secretary under George W. Bush, and so he was the first to use that waiver authority. And so far, I think the number is up to about 68 different laws that have been waived to do this. And like I mentioned before, you know, this is an unelected official, political appointee, and so, you know, people just really have to look at, you know, this as an erosion of the democratic process to allow one person just override something with the stroke of a pen.
Was there any litigation that resulted from the attempt to override those acts?
This has been challenged in court several times. In fact, fairly recently, I believe it was in 2018, that Judge Curiel out in San Diego, he heard a case presented, I believe it was from the Center for Biological Diversity or the Sierra Club, and his response was that he upheld the law because he said it is not up to the courts to remedy the poor decisions that Congress has made. And, you know, I didn't, of course, we would like to see the ruling turn out favorably, but I have respect for Judge Curiel as a justice because he basically, you know, he went along with what the legal framework would, you know, allow him to do, as opposed to, you know, what the, sometimes we're talking about activist judges. Well, you know, he was, I believe, an Obama-appointed judge, and in fact, he had ruled against the Trump University, so Trump was forced to pay about $40 million in damages 5 or 6 years ago, and he was the judge, and so everybody expected it to be different, but no, he was a, you know, fair and balanced judge.
So what are the long-term consequences of the override of these acts? Does it have implications for what happens in the future?
Yeah, I think it does, because every session of Congress, there's bills introduced to codify this and expand this even more. In fact, this last Congress, they wanted to extend this to all federal lands. You know, could you imagine that? You know, look at all the forest and parkland that exists up there in Montana. So by the letter of that law, there are those who would like to strip all the protections off of all federal lands. And that's just simply unacceptable, and I really hope that our elected officials are wise enough not to allow that to happen.
So taking a long-term view, what are the most egregious problems with the portions of the wall that exist?
The primary problem would be the loss of wildlife migration and movement routes, and then limiting the ability of species such as the jaguar to disperse up from Mexico and vice versa back and forth. You know, anything larger than a jackrabbit or a gray fox would not be able to navigate through the wall. They would be completely cut off. And, you know, the problem there is that, like you said, it's very hot down here. This is September is the hottest year on record. And then 2020 was our hottest year on record. And, You know, a lot of animals need to move great distances in order to find water and forage. So those are the effects that it's most likely to have on wildlife. But that's very difficult to observe. And so we're kind of looking at this, you know, from 50,000 feet. But it's likely that most of the damage that we see that's going to happen is going to remain unseen, you know, because, you know, think of a sick or starving, thirsty animal. Right. You know, they're going to just go off into the bushes or a crevice and hopefully die peacefully or something. But we're not probably going to be able to see those effects until we just start noticing that populations of wildlife seem a little bit smaller.
What about Mexican wolves? I gather there are populations on either side of the wall, but or of the border, but they aren't large populations.
No, they're not. I believe the latest count for the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona and New Mexico was standing at around 260, 270 animals.
Uh-huh.
And then down in Mexico, there's about 70 to 80 is the last estimate. And when we actually have seen the border wall have an effect on that. In 2017, a wolf came up out of Chihuahua and did a 600-mile round-trip journey in 32 days. And it traveled through the mountains and then the grasslands of northern Chihuahua, came up to Las Cruces, New Mexico, went down the Rio Grande, and then spent a couple days in Juarez, and then returned to where it came from in the mountains of Chihuahua. 4 years later, a wolf came out of the Gila Wilderness, went down to the same location, and then spent 3 days pacing back and forth along the border wall. That border wall did not exist in 2017, but it's there in 2021. And so, and these are, you know, satellite collared wolves, and we were able to see those data points. So that's an absolute indicator that this is inhibiting wildlife movement, and hence, you know, a recovery plan that's been going on for 25 years between two countries.
So let's move east of El Paso and where the Rio Grande runs all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. So how important to the survival animals is their ability to cross the river and then cross the border?
You know, anywhere you go, you're going to have something that's going to be affected by that. Fortunately, Texas has about the least amount of border wall. There's some that's going to resume construction here fairly soon, but the effects on wildlife there are probably less because of the nature of the border wall. There's some there; it's in segments to where things may have the opportunity to go around it. There's probably a lot of aquatic species and aquatic birds that would be affected by this. And then you also have to include the associated lighting infrastructure and then just the increased traffic that something like that brings, because, you know, you've got to build roads to get there and then patrol roads. And so it becomes this beast that keeps on, you know, having further effects that reach out because of just all the associated infrastructure to build and maintain that.
Has Big Bend National Park been affected at all?
Fortunately not. By border wall. You know, it's, you know, everything has been affected on the border to some degree. You know, Big Bend used to be a place where you could cross back and forth pretty easily to the other little towns on the other side. And there was always, you know, a pretty good agreement there where, you know, people could kind of freely go back and forth. And, you know, it was like salutary neglect and everybody kind of behaved themselves and stuff. And, but you know, there's been an increased Border Patrol presence there, but fortunately no border wall being built. That would really be a travesty.
How about the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, there's wall all around it. Santa Ana still has not had a border wall built there, and so people have really fought to protect that. My only trip down there was in 2017. I went down to when there was a big gathering and event protesting the border wall construction that could take place at Santa Ana. But it was Santa Ana and Lloyd Benson State Park were both spared by legislation that was inserted in language by Congress.
And then there's Lower Rio Grande Valley Refuge, National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, and I have not been on the ground to see what's going on there. So there's some experts down in the Lower Rio Grande Valley that I could put you in touch with that would speak more specifically to that. People have been involved in this fight for a long time.
Then west of El Paso, across the borderlands, there's Cabrillas Prieta National Wildlife Refuge in both Arizona and California, I guess.
Yeah, Cabezas Prieta is off to the western deserts of Arizona, what I call the hot deserts, as if Tucson's not hot. It's like always a gradient of heat here in Arizona. Yeah, Cabezas Prieta, unfortunately, had a lot of border wall construction done and very destructive to Fisher sand and gravel just blasted through beautiful mountains, the Tinajas Altas Mountains. It's really good populations of bighorn sheep there. And again, that was a situation where you had slopes that very few people could easily climb up. So it was just simply unnecessary to inflict that much damage upon our protected national wildlife refuge. I mean, the Oregon Pipe National Monument is right next door to it. They abut each other. And both saw really egregious damage done by blasting straight through mountains when there was simply no need to do that.
Yeah. And then there's Coronado National Forest in Arizona.
Yeah, there's the Coronado National Forest that's in five distinct ranger districts here. And but then there's also the Coronado National Memorial, and that's a National Park Service managed property. Whereas the Coronado National Forest is, of course, you know, the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Forest Service. And the monument was really heavily impacted right at the at Montezuma Peak. And so that's where the Arizona Trail begins. It's a National Scenic Trail. Again, that law was waived. And it makes you just wonder, like, why do we even have these laws if somebody's going to just be able to bypass them?
Right,
you know, that's really a slippery slope to fascism right there. But the damage that's been done at Coronado National Memorial is that's irreversible. You know, we'll see that throughout the rest of the Anthropocene.
Oh, yeah. And then there's Oregon Pipe Cactus National Park.
Yeah, that's another national monument. And And it had a lot of border wall built. I think there was 25 miles built along Oregon Pipe. And they blasted through a lot of mountains, including one called Monument Hill, which was known to be a historical Tohono O'odham burial ground. You know, people were typically buried in the rocks, you know, on this hill. And to really add insult to injury, the chairman of the nation, Tohono O'odham Nation, was testifying in Congress the day that they were blasting through it, and that was really taken as an insult by the tribe, and it directly was. There's no way around it that they actually did that for spite, and so it's really unfortunate that the last guy had a lot of really what I would say mean people in there who were very mean spirited in doing things for very disingenuous purposes.
And then there's moving, I guess, almost to the west, to the Pacific, is Tijuana Slough National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah.
And any damage done there?
Well, there's a place called Friendship Park that's on the border. And so it was an international meeting point that was actually established by Nancy Reagan. She wanted to have people on both sides who, for some reason couldn't come, have a place where they could go and picnic together on Sundays. And so they raised the binational garden there, bulldozed through that. And then they're right in the final stages of completing a 30-foot border wall in that area at Friendship Park. And then it's been closed off too. There's a place called Border Field State Park, and I grew up right down there on that part of the border. Border Field State Park, I think, was a former marine helicopter base. And now you can't even get access to that. And there are numerous places along the border where you're not allowed to access that. You can't go down along the border road at Oregon Pipe National Monument anymore. A lot of Cabeza Prieta, you can't do that. There's a wilderness area, the Jacumba Wilderness. You can't access that very easily anymore.
Why? Because they have them roped off or barriers?
Yeah, they've got things gated off, entrances to those. There's a place in eastern San Diego County in the Otay Wilderness area.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been popular routes for people that like to, you know, take Jeep rides through the mountains there. And most all of that is inaccessible. So you start adding up the numbers of how much public land we have ceded to border security.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's I remember, you know, Winston Churchill saying, like, we can't cut music and the arts and education during yeah. war, and it's because what are we fighting for?
Yeah.
And so you ask yourself, you know, why are we doing all this and spending billions of dollars only to cede away 40,000-50,000 acres to the public?
And under whose authority are those barriers in place? Is that Homeland Security?
Yeah, that's Department of Homeland Security.
Okay, there was a letter sent, about 3 or 4 years ago, by 70 organizations to the Army Corps of Engineers and to Homeland Security. Was that letter ever objecting to the wall? Was that letter ever responded to?
No. There was never any response.
And why was the Army? Why was the Army Corps involved?
The Army Corps of Engineers was who let the contracts, and they were involved in overseeing the construction of the contractors.
I see.
You know, to say, you know, here's an organization, one of the oldest in the U.S. government, goes back a long ways, you know, built, you know, a great number of dams, you know, oversaw the Panama Canal, you know, the building of the Pentagon, you know, et cetera. Their lack of oversight at the border wall was just really bad. I think it was one of their most shameful hours, the Army Corps of Engineers. They could have really minimized damage. I think that they could have had a lot more influence, but they just kind of, you know, let them do what they wanted to do.
So now with the Biden administration, has there been any change in the role that's being played by either Homeland Security or the Army Corps?
Well, there's mitigation that's occurred, and so there's reparation funds that are out there, and in fact, that's all that sausage is being made right now.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be funds that go towards restoration projects in places that were impacted by the border wall. And so we'll probably start seeing that take place over the next year.
What organizations have been most active in trying to reverse policy? And I'm talking about NGOs like yours that have been most active in trying to take the wall down or reverse its impacts.
Yeah, you know, I wish I could say that we would see some inertia to remove sections of border wall, but I don't think that's going to happen. But there's been, you know, pretty relentless efforts from Defenders of Wildlife, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity, numerous other NGOs, the Southern Border Communities Coalition, you know, that have been full-time, you know, in this battle. And there's been, you know, successes in little places, but, you know, when you've got that tremendous, you know, power of the federal government and the incredible powers that the Secretary of Homeland Security has been given, it's pretty hard to override some of that.
What allies do you have in Congress?
We have a lot of people who who would like to, you know, see border wall come down and you know, no more being built. It's amazing. It really falls along partisan lines, but it makes no logic because it's just symptomatic of the polarization in our country. Because if you go back on public record and look up statements by officials, even ones within Border Patrol, Department of Homeland Security, they have said, oh, the last thing we need is a border wall. That's going to, you know, what we need is more manpower. We need more technology on the ground. But very few people were ever advocating for, you know, huge, expansive border walls. What they really wanted was better resources in the field. And I look back and, you know, I could provide a list of names of folks who have really changed their tune. And so when you look at that data point, you say, okay, now this is just one more type of horse to beat on, and that's you know, another, you know, tribal drumbeat for one side or the other. And what's so sad is that the people in border communities are the ones that suffer from this. Yeah. The wildlife suffers from this. You know, water courses and rivers and the land is really the one that's had the toll taken on it, with very little effect on actually stemming immigration or solving crisis at the border.
Have any of the indigenous tribal groups been involved in alliance with what you're trying to do?
Yeah, the Tohono O'odham, they successfully defended their 63 miles of border. They didn't have a border wall built there. And then the Kokopah Nation, they are on western Arizona, south west of Yuma. They had 8 miles that they didn't have border wall built on, so they were able to, you know, defend their land. So, yeah, the tribes have had some success in this.
Do you think that after the 2024 election that there will be a government that will be more active in trying to stem the consequences of the border wall?
Boy, that's the million-dollar question. who can really answer that one?
Yeah.
I'm making some tea now. I could tip the cup upside down and read those leaves, but that's all I can offer you.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have run out of time, so I really appreciate the chance to talk to you and get this message, although it doesn't look too promising in the future, but I guess we'll keep our fingers crossed, huh?
Yeah, you know, and you know, up in your neck of the woods, I'd love to get up there to Bozeman sometime again, preferably maybe July, people want to get out of this heat. But I think the people up north, you should realize that if the Secretary of Homeland Security wanted to waive the laws and blow up all the mountains and peaks along Glacier National Park and Waterton, they have the authority to do that. This is all the U.S. borders. You know, they could drain the Boundary Waters canoe area if they wanted to, and that's no exaggeration. So at some point, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, somebody had the idea to build border walls between the U.S. and Canada. So I think everybody in the country needs to remain vigilant and defend our conservation legacy, which has been a role model for the rest of the world.
Miles, thank you very much. So hope we can talk again when things are looking brighter.
Anytime. Thank you, Jay.
Our guest today has been Miles Traphagen, the Borderlands Program Coordinator for Wildlands Network. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.